accession number 23186, Reel 6.
Mr. Walker, Reel 6. Anything else about the KLM convoys or that period that you recall? I know it's a period of fairly dull routine, but...
It was, Peter, yeah, it was. It's hard to remember anything outstanding. We had a man overboard.
Tell me about that.
There again, it's seamen, but being on the bridge... And they do drill with the, it was a motorboat, really. And I don't know what happened seaman-wise, but they wound the davits out, and this one chap, he was a leading seaman, I think, was in the boat itself, when all of a sudden, whatever happened, the boat crashed into the sea. And, of course, hearing the crash... You run to the back of the bridge to see what's going on. And there was a motorboat with Armitage in it passing the stern. For a shot. Man overboard. And what I did in that case was keep him in sight through the telescope while the officer of watch, the skipper, was on the bridge. Turn the ship round to try and pick him up, which we eventually did. But it was quite a hair-raising experience for him, I suppose, at the time. Because as he passed the stern of the ship, some of them in the stern said, "Jump, army!" But it's lucky he didn't. He stayed with the boat, and the boat was still there when we picked him up. So that was about the only little bit of excitement.
Now, what about D-Day time? Were you pulled off the KLM convoys to help with the D-Day, covering D-Day?
Yeah, well, we went in the channel. Still based at Belfast.
So what were you doing?
First of all, we were sweeping and ASDIC sweeps for any U-boats. And then we were escorting convoys from Portsmouth across to Le Havre and back again. That was pretty routine, but it was a bit more hectic there because there was more torpedoes flying around. And by that time, they'd become acoustic.
Were you aware of things like acoustic and magnetic torpedo, you know, this sort of the mines and all that sort of stuff?
Well, you knew they were there, yeah, that's right. And that's why your ship had always to be degaussed and all things like that. And you depended on your ASDICs and your radar and your lookouts. And, of course, in the channel, you could get some dodgy weather, like misty, foggy weather, and wet, and it was much harder to see any distance, which wasn't so good. But we were lucky. There was some, such as a Capel, that wasn't so lucky. They were torpedoed. And... Then it was on one of the trips when we were back in Belfast after. We're back in Belfast for the usual week or 10 days break, and my relief suddenly turned up from Portsmouth. Another human of signals. So.
How did you feel? I mean, how did you feel about that?
I didn't like it, but I thought, well, there's nothing I can do. But Harry Hills, he's the skipper, he said to the coxswain, who was ran another ship. He said, tell that chap not to unpack his bag and hammock. He said, because he's going straight back tomorrow. So he said to the coxswain, make out all the necessary documents and send them back. But I thought, you can't do that. But anyhow, he did. He sent him back. But of course, it wasn't to be. About a month later, another one came.
Now, when would that be in 1944? Back end of 44?
Yeah, 44, yeah.
Do you know which month, roughly?
End of November, beginning of December. And when that happened, he was ever so apologetic. He said, I'm sorry, yeoman. He said, I did it once, but he said, obviously, they're not going to stand it. I can't do it again. And there was no reason for it, I suppose. Just they do that from a drafting office in Portsmouth.
Now, would you say the Burgess was a happy ship? I mean, or what was ship morale like? Because you've got this captain and you've got the strict first lieutenant. Was it a happy ship?
I think so, overall. It was, I didn't mix much with seamen or stokers or anything like that, apart from seamen. You know, some I didn't even know their names. But I was only concerned mainly with the communication department.
But was it a sort of overall happy ship to be part of?
I think so, yeah.
So what happened? So you went back to where?
Portsmouth. To the signal school at Portsmouth. And then, after a while, I got a draft chit to a frigate called HMS Ness.
N-E-S-S?
N-E-S-S, that's right.
And where was the Ness?
Now this, believe it or not, at Fort William. So off I go toddling up to Fort William. And
this would be around December.
Yeah, and the Ness is there. And it's not doing any. So I got on there, and there again, I had to start organising the signal department. And I had to arrange for all signals. In fact, I had to take a trip to Glasgow, to Centenary Hotel, to pick up back what we called AFOs, Admiralty Fleet Orders, that just weren't there, but I had to get them, brought them all back, got them all sorted out, and while we were there, we didn't do a lot.
It was just in harbour at Fort William?
Just in harbour at Fort William.
What did you think of the ship, the frigate? What was your opinion?
Well, to be honest, Peter, I wasn't on it long enough to form an opinion. I'll tell you what happened. Then we sailed for round the north coast of Scotland to Newcastle, and we went in. It wasn't dry dock, but it was in harbour. At a place called Heaven. And I thought, well, this is no good to me. In fact, I knew very little of the captain or any of the officers or even any of the men, because by that time I was married, and my wife come over here to London to live with an aunt of mine who lived in Pimlico. And I thought, well, we're up here for some time, so I'll get her up. So she came up to Newcastle, and I met her and managed to get Diggs ashore. But during that time, I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to the Far East.
Is that where the ship was planning?
It was going there, yeah. And lucky enough, in these, there happened to be an AFO that I spotted, and it said, any member of the ship's company with ear problems, were not to go to the Far East. So I thought, well, I've got your problem.
What kind of problem did you have?
My bust eardrum. And that was done in the Nelson. When I was on the... I don't know if I mentioned it before. When I was on the flag deck on the Nelson, as a young ordinary signalman, at sea, on either side of the flag deck was anti-aircraft guns. So I happened to be over the bulkhead retrieving a flag when this damn thing went off. I always remember because it blew my hat off. But it also damaged my eardrum. So I saw the sick bay Tiffy and reported this. And he arranged for me to have an examination. And within a couple of weeks, I was drafted back to Portsmouth. So that was the finish of the nest for me. And there again, while it was in Arbor, I mean, I was ashore in the evening anyway, along with my wife. And just going back in the morning was a sort of daily thing. So that was the only... So I was back to Portsmouth, and then back to the signal school, a few weeks in there, and I suppose through my ear trouble, which I now get a pension for, by the way, I was drafted to Fort Blockhouse, HMS Dolphin, now, on the staff of Flag Officer Submarines.
Now, HMS Dolphin was what? As a shore station?
It was the submarine base. The only one they had in those days. All the submarines that came to Portsmouth were based there.
And the fort was?
Fort Blockhouse, that's what they called it, Fort Blockhouse.
Was that part of the complex? Was there an actual HMS Dolphin, or was it a shore station?
Yeah, no, it was a shore station. And that's where they trained all the submariners. Anybody volunteering for submarine service went there, and they did they had the deep sea training tank there and everything, so they did all the training for submarines there. But our main job there was mainly in the signal office, as it were. There was one chief yeoman, two or three yeomen, leading signalmen, wrens, and leading signalmen, all to do with the internal distribution of the signals. And it was all watchkeeping. Like, there'd be one yeoman and a leading signalman and a few Jenny Wrens manning the watch in the signal office. And it was all telephones. There was nothing visual or anything like that.
Now, two things. What was the routine on telephone? What was the telephone routine you had at the time? Because we've talked a lot about visual signal, but not a lot about the sort of telephone routine and operation of the switchboard or whatever. Could you tell us what your job
was?
Well,
all we had was just a normal desk and a telephone, and any signals came through there.
Just a single telephone. So you weren't on the switchboard at all?
No. That was Jenny Wrens and the other Jenny Wrens. And being a yeoman, you were just there for any information that you might say. Yeah, what can I do about this?
So you got your signals by telephone?
Yeah.
And was there a sort of proper procedure on the phone that you'd had to learn, you know, almost like a wireless procedure?
No. It was just a case of reading. All the signal pads were made out to... from and who it was going to, you know. It might be, say, from Admiralty to Flag Officer Submarines, repeated one of the submarines, whatever the name was, Albatross, from Admiralty, and that was it. And then it would start off, message begins, blah, 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 blah. TOR, which was time of origin, and the time and the date. And then when that signal was received, it was stamped and logged and copies made for all the different people who should see it. And then it was the job of one of the lower down signalmen to take it and distribute it to all these officers.
Now, would you actually be on the phone? Would you actually be taking orders on the phone?
Not really. You were just, I had a phone and a desk. And it was 24 hours on and 24 hours off.
What I mean is, and I don't mean, I'm just saying, why did they need a trained signaller, a trained visual signaller to answer the telephone? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, well, mainly to do with the administration of the signals and the way the signals were laid out, how they should be distributed, who should see them, make sure everybody saw them, that should see them, and just the general running of an SDO, a signal distributing office.
They were using your administrative skills, that's not right. Your signalling skills.
No.
And the other point I want to ask is, how did you get on with having wrens in your section? You know, in other words, female.
Yeah, well, you didn't have a lot of trouble with them, really, because they just got on with their job, you got on with theirs, but...
Were you actually in command of them as well? I'm not coming in. They were a part of your section, were they?
Yeah, well, I was on there, you know.
Did you find it difficult to deal with them, or...?
Not really, because... You had the chief yeoman, he was there... and the background, as it were, but if he was a yeoman on watch, morning and first, as I said before, all the different watches, and then you had a leading signalman and some leading wrens and Jenny wrens taken down, and they also... which I should have mentioned, a teleprinter.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, I didn't know a lot about it. Jenny Wren's, it was just an ordinary teleprinter, and messages come through, and you could reply to it.
But they just passed the messages to you, and messages to them. You didn't actually use it or understand
it. No, I couldn't use it. Because you had the... proper teleprinter operators, you know, to do that.
Now, I should have asked before, when did you start at HMS Dolphin? Was it into January 45 or...
Around about that time.
It was after Christmas.
Yeah. And, as I say, I was there right till I was demobbed.
Now, where were you billeted or living?
In the petty officers. In the petty officers, well, that's not true. Because what I used to do, if I was on watch, I had a billet in the petty officer's mess. But if it was my 24 hours on, I wasn't actually on watch in the SDO, I'd be in the petty officer's mess. But then it was my 24 hours off, so I headed for London, which was... I forget the fare in those days, but it was quite cheap. You get on the train at Portsmouth Harbour Station. You're in Waterloo in an hour and a half. And jump on the tram and I was home.
Now, where was home at the time?
Pimlico.
You...
Which is just the other side of Vauxhall Bridge. And I spent the day with my wife because I was off from... 11 o'clock, say today, till 11 o'clock tomorrow, I'm due back. So I used to get the train at Waterloo about 9 o'clock in the morning, and you're back in Portsmouth at 10:30. And then you'd be on duty for another 24 hours, and then 24 hours off, which was a good thing. And that was went on until, as I say, I was demobbed from Blockhouse.
Did you enjoy the work at HMS Dolphin?
It was just, we knew the war was getting near an end. And you had the VE Day in between, like, you know.
Tell us about VE Day. What were the celebrations like there?
Well, it was... I can't remember much about them, really, in Portsmouth. Because being in barracks, you know, and on duty, you didn't see a lot. And there was no jumping around in the barracks or anything like that, you know. But, and then you saw it on television or on the pictures we had in those days, cinema, of the celebrations in London, which, as you can imagine, was a bit more hectic than what they were.
Were you pleased it was all over?
I was, really. I was, really. And you want to get back to civilian life, obviously.
So you said, when were you demobbed?
I think it was probably round about September, October.
That early?
Yeah.
45?
I was out, that's right. That's right. I suppose being one of the early ones in, one of the early ones out. So.
Do you remember the demob procedure?
Yeah, you go through and you get, what did they give you? A suit, shoes, socks, shirt, trilby hat, tie, a civilian outfit. And you picked your own, you know, black and brown shoes and suit. What colour suit they looked at you, you know, usual. Oh, I love that one, yeah, and that's it. And you got all your gear, and you got all your documents, your release document, and you were on your way. You got a pass to your home, and that was it.
Now your home wasn't Lockerbrig anymore.
You went back to Scotland from the day I joined up, apart from visits, but never to live.
So you'd been doing this massive apprenticeship, which you hadn't finished. So what did you plan to do?
So, well, they had the, what they call an interrupted apprenticeship scheme. So I went, I think, the Labour Exchange in the first instance, and they told me where it was. And then I went and saw the officer and explained what happened. I was in the middle of an apprenticeship when I joined that. All right. And, of course, they had all... I think places were probably duty-bound to take people in those days. So, anyhow, I was sent to this firm, and it was only a small firm, but quite a nice firm. And I stayed there for...
And this was to finish your compositors?
Yeah, apprenticeship, that's right.
And were you able, I mean, had you remembered it all? I mean, it's the last five years, 6 years.
It gradually comes back. And I went to the London School of Printing in Stamford Street and did classes there. And you gradually get more and more and more, comes back. So this firm I was at was non-union. And I was there, I stayed there about a couple of years, and till I'd finished what they said was the finish of my apprenticeship.
So you'd qualified?
Yeah. So I explained to them, I said, well, I'm not too happy staying as a working in a non-union shop, but I would like to make application to join, which at that time was the London Society of Compositors, which was in Fleet Street, in St Bride Street, off Fleet Street, which I did do, and they accepted me as a member, and course, I had to go and work in a place that they told me, which was for 2 years as a probationer. They find out, I suppose, how I was, how I got on, how much you knew your job. Well, I was lucky enough to do that, and it was in quite a good place. Did my 2 years. Then I went and applied for a job at the Cornwall Press in Stanford Street, which was a huge organisation. There was 200 compositors there, all in one big room. And you were all split up into what they called ships, doing different periodicals. And I was there for till 1947 or 48, when the union had a strike. Well, in those days, you didn't get any labour exchange money, so you didn't. The longer the strike went on, and you only got a few bob from the society, which wasn't enough to keep you really. So the longer the strike went on, the worse it was. But what happened? Yeah, I think, yeah, that's right. There were some firms that were excused by being on specialised work. So I happened to be coming up Vauxhall Bridge Road one day with my young son from school, and I happened to see this big tall chap with silver hair standing in the doorway of this printer's in Vauxhall Bridge Road called Love and Malcolmson. So I just happened to chat to him, and he happened to be the printer. So I told him who I was and what happened. He said, "Do you want a job?" I said, "Well, I wouldn't mind." So I took a job there and told my firm at Cornwall Press I wouldn't be coming back, which was all right, no problems. And I was there for a little while. Then I went to another firm, transferred to newspapers, and I retired from the Daily Mail.
So you worked as a compositor for them?
A compositor on pop metal on the Daily Mail when I retired. And I was there for about 3 years. But before that, I'd worked in various other newspapers, the Financial Times, and did a stint on the Star, and I also did a month stint on the Evening Standard.
Now, how do you think that your war experiences had affected you, good and bad, mentally and physically? Had they left any bad or good effects?
No, I don't think so, Peter, apart from being bust ear, of which I'll get a pension for.
Any good effects?
No, nothing spectacular. Well, I met my wife. That was the best thing that ever happened to me. And we had a good life, 54 years.
Thank you very much.